Ching, ching, bling, bling. Let's cut the chatter. In today's episode, it's Vino Condino, winemaking cork soaking expert. Welcome to the Tucci Talks Wealth, Health, and Everything Else podcast. I'm your host, David Tucci, an educator, a father of three. Join me as I take you on a funky journey through life, from a reckless young man to a humbled older man. Each week, I will offer different insights on my life experiences and the experiences of others, and how that has shaped our present day realities. So let's begin our funky journey into improving our health, wealth, and you guessed it, everything else. Another weekday. Oh yes, it's Monday. No, you did. I'm still here. I don't think so. Way too far. It's time to start the show. So let's go. Welcome. Welcome, welcome, welcome. We made it back from last week's episode as we kicked off Financial Education Month in style. I definitely need a mental break after last week's episode, so we will be keeping it light today. The shout-out streak continues as Craig from Brampton, Ontario guest Money, Money, Money by ABBA. Way to go, my friend. If you know this week's crazy karaoke, just send me an email, david@tuccitalks75.com. Or contact me on the various social media platforms at TucciTalks75. Thank you to all the listeners who have been liking and subscribing and leaving reviews. It really helps the podcast grow. Much love to you all. Before we get into today's episode, let's recap last week's. What did I learn from having Antonio on the podcast last week? I was going to go on a bit of a rant and talk about how the Federal Reserve is a cartel and we are all puppets in this massive play on the world stage, but I decided to keep it simple. It's time for all of us to begin to learn how to tie our own shoes. When we were all kids at one point, we had no idea what the concept of shoe tying was. Then your parents showed you what it meant to tie your own shoes. So now you are aware of this concept. But what happened when you began to try and tie those laces? You struggled mightily. You had no clue how to tie your own laces, but you practiced and then practiced some more until one day you understood what shoe tying was and you were able to execute the skill of tying those damn laces, giving you the ability to finally tie your own shoes. Job well done. And that, my beautiful friends, is what you need to start doing with your finances. Begin with simple concepts that we all need. Learn slowly. There really is no rush. Until one day, you finally learn how to tie your own financial shoes, one lace at a time. Good luck and stay vigilant. All right, that's too heavy for me for a Monday, so let's lighten things up with my next guest. He is a man of many talents, and those talents are always put to the test. He is a father of two. He has a son and a daughter that are all grown up, and he is also a son to an Italian father that treated him as my father had treated me. The Italian tradition of winemaking was passed down from father to son, father to son. He is here today to share that tradition with all of us. I am super thrilled to welcome Dino Vespa to Tucci Talks.
Hey,
Okay, so thanks for coming. Thanks for coming on the show today. Are you excited to talk wine?
I'm very excited, and so excited, in fact, that I made sure that I had a glass ready as well to go. So
I love that. Now, we had a small discussion via email earlier in the week, and we were discussing corking, and I had asked you, what's the deal with that? Because I'm not sure if many listeners have noticed, but there seems to be less and less corked wine bottles at the liquor store and more capped ones, at least here in Canada anyway. So I had assumed that it was more like of a cleanliness issue, because I was reading on some forums that some people were not soaking their corks in like a K-Meta solution while others did. But you had mentioned something interesting. You said that you cap your wine that you make, and you'll only cork it when presenting it as a gift. And if I may, you also mentioned that when it comes to sanitation, you just soak the cork in water. So what's the deal here? Are corks no longer in the industry? Is there a correct way to sanitize? Just shed some light if you can.
Okay, no problem. Well, I mean, as far as corks are concerned, when you really look at why there's not a lot of corks, or at least not as many corks as there used to be, it comes down to marketing. If you go back in the 2000s, what happened was is there were problems with corks, as you mentioned, with issues with sanitation. And they had measured, certain companies measured their wines and realized that some of them were going bad. So what they did is they tried other alternate solutions. So, I mean, one of them obviously is the plastic cork. You know, have you ever seen them? They look like styrofoam.
I haven't, but I'm not a big wine drinker. So that's why I'm just listening with intrigue now.
Okay. So there was the time there in the early 2000s where they were trying to get away from corks because of that very purpose. Now what happened is you have the millennials, which were coming of drinking age. And what happens is they grew up with bottles of wine not really having corks, like having caps, if you will.
Right.
So this is like what happened was is, so what you do is you've got an older generation that kind of remembers wine that's capped, and they associate it with cheap wine. And then you have millennials who look at it and say, well, I'm a little sheepish about having a wine that has a cork because
saying that the older generation would think the wine is cheaper if it came in a cap?
Correct.
Wow.
Yeah. So but you know what, to kind of clear that issue, a good wine is a good wine. It doesn't matter whether it comes with a real fake cork or a cap. It's what it is. It's marketing. As from my research, as far as corks are concerned, Portugal produces, they have 35% of the cork trees of the world, and they still use cork. They have better methods of cleaning and stuff like that. And the thing about is you have to keep in mind too, this bacteria that gets in cork, this can come from wine barrels as well.
Yeah.
Okay, this comes from trees. Okay, it can actually come from on the vines of the grape. I mean, like there's all kinds of areas where it comes from. It just doesn't come from the corks.
Right? Okay, so that makes sense. I appreciate, you know, that's value there, and I think listeners appreciate that value. So I'm gonna get into the title of this episode, and I like to get a little bit creative and funky with my titles. This one is called Vino Condino, Winemaking Cork Soaking Expert. The title is a homage to your Italian roots and to my dad, who's also Italian. And he's super excited to listen to this episode. He makes his own wine as well. And he's interested in the winemaking process from start to finish from a winemaking expert. So I had asked a guest that I had on for Oktoberfest episode. So I'm going to ask you the same question. On a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being expert. Mm-hmm. What level would you consider your winemaking skills?
Well, I don't know. We do the traditional winemaking, and it's really winemaking how winemaking has been here since 7,000 BC, and how
nice.
Wine has been made.
Nice.
So I think as far as making it, I think we're pretty up there, maybe above 7.5, 8, I would say.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
I love that. So before we get into the winemaking process, I want to ask you, how did you develop such an affinity for wine, and where did it come from?
Well, the thing about alcohol, and particularly wine, and I think it's a lot to do with culture, right? Because growing up, there was always wine on the table, and it was always homemade wine. Yeah, my parents bought store-bought wine and stuff like that. But my Italian grandparents, to buy, why? Why were you going to buy wine?
Yeah, why are you spending money?
I have a whole cantina of wine. Why do I need to buy it, you know? So... But yeah, you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, right? Totally.
But anyways, what it did is associated with the culture, it associated with the family, especially meal times. Meals that's it's part of the meal. You know what I mean? And that's really where it comes from.
So just as a young boy, so like when was the earliest you had a glass of wine? When I'd have at 7 years old, my dad would give me a glass of wine.
Yeah, I mean, as long as I was old enough to be able to put my glass on the table and ask for it, I could have it. So,
yeah, and it wasn't like shit. This. It wasn't like this evil.
No, it's not at all, and it's nothing like that was locked up in our house at all. I mean, like obviously, if you were to indulge and maybe not feel too well the next day, I mean, that was kind of a natural consequence of over consuming. Right. But it was never locked up or it was never hidden or anything like that. It was always in full view. And even with my kids today, I'm the same way. I mean, I guess the newer generations aren't into as wine as much. I know my son, he's 22 and he prefers like those, I don't know, coolers or whatever.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Margarita
yeah.
cooler. Ah, too much what, sugar for me.
But. Does he drink wine? With a meal or no, he just, it's just not his thing.
You know what? I always have it at the table and I would say for most nights I do have it, but, the kids, not so much, but you know what I mean? If I offer it and he'll sometimes accept it and stuff like that. I feel that wine is, especially wine, I guess it's acquired taste. I mean, when you have, and this is going back to marketing again as well, you know, when you have marketing and such where they're kind of like making them almost like soda pop. So, you know, teenagers are coming to drink, they're at drinking age. Yeah. And all of a sudden it's like, oh, well, why don't we just have something similar to what you used to drink, but only now it has alcohol in it. To me, has always been a turnoff. Like if I want a pop, I'll have a pop. Right.
But I agree. You know, so. And I guess it does lend itself, like you said, to the marketing and they're just trying to make money.
Yeah, it's all marketing, but I mean, you know, when you look at homemade wine, I mean, just to go back to how we actually bottle it, right? Let's see, it's kind of recycled. Like, so what we do anyways, and I learned this from my father, was that, you know, he likes to buy the Perrier bottles.
The water, yeah.
Yeah, and the carbonated water. So one day he got an idea, so I buy all these bottles, why don't I just put the wine in them? And the caps are actually really nice. They seal really well. You clean them. So all you do is you sanitize and clean the, you know, these bottles.
Okay, so can we, before you get into that, let's jump. Yeah. I was going to jump right in to now. Okay. It might get a little bit intricate. I don't have a problem. I'm here to learn. I want to get into the winemaking process. Like I said, my dad is going to be listening. Okay. So can you just take us through your process? And like I said, if I don't understand something, I'll interject. But
no problem.
How does it all go down?
Well, contrary to popular belief, you have to start with grapes.
Why do you say that? Because now it's not like that.
Well, I have to. Yeah. Well, all I'm saying. Okay, I remember I was in the hall. We were talking about this episode, and I told you this old that story about the old vintner, the old
share it.
Well, I mean, when you taste wine nowadays, it's like, okay, what did they make it with? I don't really taste, you know. So the story goes like this. It's an old winemaker in the village, and he has his two sons by his deathbed. And he's on by his bedside. And he says, before I pass on into, another life or, you know, into when I pass on from this world, I have to tell you a secret, right? So the older son, he says, come close. I have to tell you. He says, yes, father, what is the secret? And he says, sometimes... wine is made from grapes. You can make wine out of anything.
I get, yeah.
But the best thing is grapes. I mean,
anyway. That's where you're gonna get the real essence of the wine.
Well, you see, grapes, the thing about grapes is they have the best taste, they have, and they have the most sugar content per fruit. Do you know what I mean?
Okay, so you start with the grapes. Yeah. Where do you get them?
Okay, well, we normally go to a place near where we live, and what happens is they open up basically, you know, like around winemaking season time. So that's usually about the beginning of September. And I think they go all the way until the middle of October or something like that. So these grapes, they come from California. All right, so they're shipped over.
Okay.
And you purchase them by the crate, and you can get them anywhere from, I think it's 42. We usually get the 42 pound, there's 45 pound, and I think you can get the smaller ones, which are like 35 or something like that. So that's one thing to do. So once you get your grapes, and you pick the grape that you want, whatever kind of grape that you'd like to make your wine from. And so once you get the grapes, you take them home, and you have to have the right equipment to do it, right? So the first thing you need to do is you need to crush them.
Okay, so you take the grapes home, they go in the garage, I'm assuming?
Yeah, you can put them in the garage or, you know, whatever place that you have where you want to store them.
And then you start, what do you have to get going?
Well, I should mention as well that before we crush them, we usually like to spread them out on a large tarp, and we like to go through them. So we like to pick out leaves, if there's any insects.
Wow, that's a lot of, that's
rodents. You can put it in, but the thing is if something's in there, it'll spoil the wine, you know, to check it. We like to check it. And also too, it's good to warm them up, because remember, the fermentation can start the warmer the grape is, right?
So you're warming them? So are you keeping the garage heated?
Well, what you do is before you crush them, say if it's a nice sunny day in the morning, you just lay them outside on a tarp and just let them sit for a little while you're picking
them.
Oh,
not too long.
Okay. No, it doesn't have to be too long. But the thing is they'll warm up faster if they're spread out than if they're all stuck in the crate.
Right. Yeah. So then you get them in and you got to start crushing them.
That's right. So a crusher, now I don't know if you've ever seen a crusher. It has like a V-shaped kind of top so that it goes in like a funnel.
Yeah. Okay. I've seen that.
It has a metal barrel inside with spikes.
Okay.
And it's all one piece. This thing has all been molded to one piece. And now, okay, see, this is the one thing I want to make sure that I make perfectly clear over here. There's always the old style of, say, making wine and making tomato sauce and stuff like that. And then what you can do is you can mechanize it by merely adding power, right? So originally was a hand crusher.
Hand crank. So you guys were just cranking.
Yeah. So my father's a machinist. And I remember he basically decided, we're not going to do it this way. I'm going to hook a motor up to it. So he hooked the motor up to it with a switch, okay, forward and reverse. So if the thing gets stuck, you can reverse it out.
Dynamite. Right?
Yeah.
Dynamite.
So this part of the process, you know, we, with this machine, you get a couple guys, you know, like have, you know, good strength and stuff like that. And you just start crushing them into the barrel. So the thing goes on top of the barrel.
Yeah.
And then you just start crushing it.
You feed it, and so where is the residual stuff coming out from?
Well, we crush everything.
Oh, the skins, everything.
Some people destem them. We actually don't destem them. And I know a lot of people are like, oh, that's going to put, you know, the taste in the wine and this, that. You know what? It's just one extra step. We don't do it. I mean, some people do destem. We just crush everything.
And you guys probably think that it's not worth the work because the quality of the wine is...
You know, it's kind of funny because you can go to a place and what they'll do is you get your containers and what they can do is they'll destem them for you right there as long as you have your containers and you can do that. So, I mean, it's a little extra work. And of course, obviously the whole money factor. So
I'm not going to pay extra.
I'm going to pay an extra dollar?
Yeah.
So that you can destem my grip? Nah, I'll take it home and do it myself.
Some listeners from the U.S. and other parts, Italians, especially the ones like our parents who came here, they don't want to pay a penny extra. So we would be like, what's a dollar? Who cares? De-stem it. Not them.
No.
Anyway, so continue.
Okay. So anyways, it goes into a barrel when you crush it. Now, what we did this year, we have three families that are making wine together. And my dad decided that he didn't want to do barrels, right? He said, what he did is he acquired this food grade container.
Okay.
The thing is 1,000 liters.
Okay? Wow.
So what we did is we crushed everything on the top of this. So one grape, we did Malbec this year. That's the only grape we used. And
what's the grape called?
Malbec.
From California?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
California Malbec. So
like, then I'm assuming in the past you've had different assortments of grapes?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And in the past we've had Cabernet Sauvignon, Shiraz, Cabernet Franc.
Yeah.
What else have we had? The big one, okay, for old school Italians is the Grenache.
Okay.
Yeah, no, my papa known Grenache. Gotta have Grenache. Right? And it's good wine, but see, yeah, Grenache is a grape that's better with other grapes. So we would put other grapes with it.
Gotcha.
But my dad decided, you know what, when we make a wine, it's gonna have one grape. That's it. We're not mixing anymore.
That was this year.
No, we've actually been doing it for a long time now.
Oh, so now it's just one grape.
No, we used to say, okay, we're going to make some Malbec, we're going to make some Cab Sauv, and we're going to make some Shiraz. This year, it's like, no, we're doing it in one container, one grape, that's it.
Gotcha. Right?
So that's what we did. So it all got crushed into this huge container, and we got it filled halfway.
So that's 500 liters.
You're looking probably between 450 and 500 liters of wine that we made this year.
Damn. Yep. Are you going to give me a bottle to try?
Sure.
Oh, I love it. I love it.
And I'll even cork it for you. Put a nice little label on there. And I'll say Vino di Dino on it. Just
so
for
then,
you.
Okay, what happens after that now? So you have this, is it a vat? Would that be accurate?
It is comparable to a vat. It's a fermentation vessel. It's in its primary fermentation. All right. Now, the other thing that you need to know is we don't add yeast. We only use whatever yeast is on the grape itself. So that's, we don't wash them, by the way. We don't wash the grapes. Everything is natural. This is how traditionally wine has been made for millennia. Okay.
Okay.
Now, people like to add yeast and do different things because you can get different, you can get more control over the fermentation, the taste. Various factors you can put in there.
Isn't that beneficial then?
Well, remember one thing: when you do natural, okay, when you're doing the natural way of it, is you're going to get whatever yeast is on the grape and whatever taste it wants to give you, right?
Got you.
Okay. Now it's very similar to your friend there who was doing he was telling you about how there's the natural fermentation in beer.
Right. Right.
Okay. Yeah, so when you're talking about those I think it was the wheat beers and a lot of the beers that are made by monks,
okay,
right, the triples and all that kind of stuff. The way that they would do it, this happened like in Belgium and stuff like that. They'd literally have the vat sitting outside with the top open.
Yeah, he was saying that. Yeah. He said that same thing.
Exactly, and then whatever.
And it would be whatever natural. Yeah,
exactly.
It was organic. Exactly.
Oh yeah, and I've had some beers and they were pretty funky tasting, but very nice, very nice, very natural, yeah, yeah. So, but we use the yeast that's on the grapes, and then what they do is they have to sit in there, and then they have to, now, my father, I introduced this to my father because what they would do is they would do it old school where they would just basically let it crush the grapes. So now you've got like this mash, as it was in the times, moust.
Yeah.
You know, just a, you know, it's just sitting there, it's bubbling.
Okay. Right?
So what happens in olden days,
and that's happening on its own.
That's happening on its own. That's correct. Yeah. Right. So what basically happens is when that bubbling stops, then that means fermentation's over. Now we do a little more scientific approach to it as you measure the original gravity. Okay. Of the wine. And you want to make sure that you get the original gravity where it needs to go.
What does that mean?
Well, okay. So original gravity is how much sugar content is present in the juice.
Okay.
Okay.
And there's a tool to measure that.
That's right. It's called a hydrometer.
Okay.
All right. And I always like using it because I know where I start and I know where I have to finish, right?
Got you.
Yeah. And I just basically do that. No, actually, I should say that my father introduced that to my papa, known his father.
Okay.
And then, of course, I would go a step further. I actually... I also include temperature control. All right, because the temperature is so important to control. You have to make sure it's consistent. You don't want it fluctuating, and you don't want it too cold.
So this is happening in the garage, this fermentation?
Yes, I made sure that we make the wine in a temperature-controlled garage.
Got you. And that's what you're controlling, the temperature with the gauge, the thermometer that you have, if you have to.
Yeah, there's actually a heater inside there. So when it gets below a certain degrees, we usually do it around 22 Celsius is where I like to ferment the wine.
So what would happen if you didn't manage the temperature?
Okay, so what will happen is you want it to be a steady bubbling or steady fermentation. So if you have the right temperature, all right.
What would it be for someone who's listening, who's considering making their own wine? What would that temperature be?
I would not make wine unless it's being fermented in between. I'd say the lowest would be 18 degrees Celsius and the highest maybe 25,
okay,
26. Because what happens is if it's too low, it will ferment slowly, and then that's how you can introduce bacteria into your wine, because it's not happening fast enough.
Yeah. Yep.
And if it's too warm, it will go too fast. And also too, natural yeast or yeast in and of itself, particularly like say, for example, let's just take beer, for example.
Okay.
Beer yeast can only ferment so high before it gets strained, and then the yeast will just die. And then it just stops fermenting. Yeah. That's why you don't have beer yeast that can produce alcohol content anywhere past like 9 or 10%.
Okay.
See, wine yeast is different. It's because it's a different strain, right? We're not talking about grain we're talking about grapes, right?
Fruit.
So the wine can ferment like just off the natural yeast. You can get a bottle of wine, it can go almost up 20%.
Amazing.
Just naturally.
Yeah. Altering the dynamic.
Yeah, I mean, you don't want it that high. Now, so once you get it that high, what's happening now is that you're not going to get any higher. And then that's when you start getting into distillation, when you start distilling, like making hard liquor and stuff like that.
So so speaking of the fermentation process, you know how sometimes with plants, you help them grow by speaking to them?
Yes.
I know you're a badass, kick-ass drummer. You could have played professionally. That's how good you are. And I've heard you play drums. Do you play, do you beat on those drums for the grapes? If you need them to behave a certain way, do you get it going and fire it up?
Okay. I have another story I have to tell you now though.
Okay. Go for it.
Okay. If you would like to sing to your wine or strum the guitar gently to your wine, I'm sure that would be fantastic, but you do not want to drum around your wine. Okay, because growing up, I remember we had, and I was just there. That's why I was a little bit late today. It's because I was at my parents' house, and my dad had to tell me a couple of philosophical stories before I went. To make sure that he was teaching me something. You know how dads are.
We don't know anything.
I gotta go. So anyway. So basically. We used to have our musical equipment. There was like two parts of our basement, right? There was the main part, and then we would call the other part of the basement, we just call it the other side of the basement, or the other side, right? So on the other side of the basement was the musical equipment. And of course, in that part of the basement, there was the cantina as well. So I come home from school every day, right? And I'm just banging on the drums, just come home, just crazy, just drumming. And then I remember one day my dad, he came out and he was siphoning some wine, and he came out and he says, "Look what you do." "Yeah, what did I do?" "Look, the wine's not clear. What the hell are you doing? Stop drumming already. Oh my, you're screwing up my wine." I'm like, oh my God.
So he blamed the drumming for up the wine process.
That's right. So at that point, it was kind of funny. There was a property. I remember there was a property that we tore down to build the house that they live in there now. And it was an older house. It was from the 1840s, like an old farmhouse. And it had this addition on the back of it. It was probably about a 10 by 12 room. It was built in 1957. He actually kept that. And then we moved it to the other side of the property. We built a door and built a wall, and he says, "This is where you're going to play the drums from now on. So we had what we call a practice shed. And yeah, that's where, and I'm telling you, like, for what you say about drumming, I mean, I had all the time in the world to go in there and play and to hone my craft, whether it was drums, guitar, or whatever.
Right. And you did. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You're phenomenal. And you twirl the sticks. And that's amazing. Okay. Back to the wine now.
Yeah, so yeah.
What percentage of alcohol do you want it at? And do you measure, can you measure that?
Well, that, see, this is what the hydrometer does. It's what it does is you get the original gravity. Now, the way that a hydrometer works is it's set to zero, and the way it's set to zero is the weight of water. All right. So if you were to take this hydrometer, it's like a little glass cylinder, right? And it's got a really skinny top to it. All right. So you put that in there, and inside, because remember, there's no air inside this glass cylinder. There's just the label, which shows you the markings.
Okay.
Right. If you put that in a glass of water and let it rest, it should mark zero. The actual zero point should, but it should just crest slightly over the water. And that's how you calibrate your hydrometer, because you're comparing the reading that you have to the weight of water.
Okay.
Okay. Okay. Now, one thing you might not know is wine is actually lighter than water. Did you know that?
I would not know that. Okay. I would not know that.
Because wine starts off at, we're going to say, okay, so the measuring of wine, usually it starts off at, okay, so water's 1.000, okay? You should get a reading of 1.085, probably to about 1.095, 1.1, when wine is about ready, when you're going to ferment it, right?
Right.
So when that wine is finished, that should go down to 0.990.
Okay.
So that's below the weight of water. So it actually, wine is lighter than water.
So, and that's what you want.
Yes, because now we're going into, is the wine dry or does it have more sugar content? So usually the drier wines are going to finish below zero.
Okay.
Okay. And the sweeter wines are going to be a little, maybe a little closer to zero, maybe even a little above zero.
So if somebody wants a sweeter wine, they make sure that that's the reading.
Yeah. And a lot of it has to do with the grape too, as well.
Gotcha. Right?
So, but all I'm saying is there's more sugar present in a sweeter wine than there is in a drier wine.
Yeah, I'm just trying to follow along. And in another episode, I did a recap and I talked about gifts. And I said one of my gifts is knowing that I have no clue about anything, and I'm willing to listen, listen and learn. So, is that when you start to bottle it? At that point,
to go back to the processes, once you've crushed it. Right. What you want to do is you want it to sit into the skins, and you also want to get that reading as close to zero as possible. Right.
Okay.
So once you've crushed it, and like I said, as you can see over here, my glass of wine is very red. Okay.
Yep,
well,
yeah.
If I were to crush it and to take it out of the skins right away, it would not be this color. It would be a lot lighter, like a rosé.
Hmm. Right. Okay.
Okay. So the whole idea.
So then rosés don't sit in the skins as long.
They don't sit in the skins at all.
At all.
Oh, maybe a little bit, but we make rosé, and what we do is we crush them,
and then
we press it right away.
Gotcha.
And then it comes to be rosé. Now white wines, because on this subject over here, there are certain grapes that are red that you can make white wines out of, and what they do is they don't even crush them. They just press the juice out of them very gently, and they make red. Like, for example, Cabernet Sauvignon, you can use that grape to make white wine, or a Sangiovese, or a Tempranillo.
Wow.
All you do is press them really gently, get the juice out of them, but don't let the skins come in contact with the juice. So
this sounds like a process, and it's interesting to see the different wines and how they're created. It really is. From someone like me, who I don't know anything about wines.
Well, I mean, the process itself actually is pretty straightforward. So going back to the crushing, once it's ready, then you press it. And you've probably seen it before. Like in Italian, it's a torchio. You
know, yeah.
What do you call it? The wine press, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, yeah, click, 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 click. Remember?
Yeah, yeah. Right? So that's pressing the...
You get all the juice out, right?
Right.
Now, mind you, talking about that huge container, that huge vat that we were using, we didn't have to press too much this year because of the actual gravity. So we had like a spigot right at the bottom of it, and you just open that up when it was ready. And then what we did is we start putting it in buckets and then putting them in the barrels, right? And this is straight juice. Like, it's actually wine now. It's very cloudy. It's probably, you could drink it. It has alcohol content in it.
So you're just, are the barrels the Dommy Johns?
No, we're not even, well, that's the next step.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, so what you do is you get all the juice naturally, put them in barrels, and then you take the grapes, the whatever's left, or the mousse, and then you put it in the torque.
Okay.
And then you press it and get as much, as you can. Okay, and then after that, that goes into the barrels, all right? And then that has to sit there, just finish up, just until it finally gets as low as possible. It stops fermenting, all right? And you want it to stop fermenting. You don't want it to keep fermenting when you put it in the damage jar,
you don't want it fermenting.
No, the final step is the conditioning, where you actually are going to let it sit and clear out in the demijohn, and you want it to have very little, if no fermentation, because if it's still bubbling and still fermenting fairly hard in the demijohn, you're going to get cloudy wine. You're going to get wine that's going to taste funky. You could even blow a demijohn if you have it capped off too hard, because you're supposed to have an airlock on the top so any gas can escape freely so it doesn't get trapped.
So I've seen my dad's, and he had like a cork on top of it.
Yeah.
Does that allow gas to?
You can cork the top, provided that you're 100% sure that it's not going to be fermenting, because you don't want gas building up there. You could blow a demijohn.
So if you're not 100% sure, don't do that.
No, what you would do is put a bung, which is like a rubber cork, and it has a hole in it.
Yep.
Just a small hole. And then what you do is you put this little plastic vessel called an airlock. And the way that it's built is we usually put grappa, there's some kind of hard liquor so that it doesn't spoil.
Okay.
In there. And what it does is it keeps all the bacteria out, and it lets the gas escape.
Escape. Yeah.
So that it doesn't build up.
So how long is it sitting in the demijohn?
So the way that we do it is we will let it sit in the demijohn. And what I like to do is the first time that I actually try the wine is on St. Martin's Day in December, because St. Martin is the patron saint of winemaking. So that's the gauge we use. You always check it to make sure that it's okay. And if it's good, then you know that come Easter, right? Okay. When that's really when you start drinking the new wine. You're going to have a really good batch. You can drink it at Christmas. It'll be young wine. All right. But the whole goal is to try to keep the wine that you made the previous year until around Easter. And then you start the new wine on Easter.
Have you ever spoiled a batch?
Oh my gosh.
I'm going to take it. I'm going to take it. That's
my gosh. Okay. All right. Okay. There's two times I remember. I don't know whether it was because Kretchen, it was his final term as prime minister, or it's because my father decided to make it in the garage in the middle of October. That was a very bad year. Cause what happened was this, we started late. He probably got grapes that weren't the greatest because it was right at the end of the buying season. And it was one of the coldest Octobers that we've seen in a long time. And he wanted to make the wine in the garage because he was sick and tired of doing it in the house and getting it messy and carrying everything up and down the stairs.
Right.
The wine never fermented properly. And it was just,
it was, you had to throw it all.
No. When I say it was bad, it was still drinkable, but it wasn't up to the standard that we were normally used to. And of course, like a proud Italian does, is you drink it with a smile on your face, even though you're crying inside. This is good, wonderful. you know, it might have been the end of going back to the whole natural process, we don't filter our wine, right?
At all?
No, it's all natural. It's a natural process called racking, right? So what you do is you go from the largest container and then you just keep filtering it and let the sediment get to the bottom. And then what you do is you siphon it into a smaller container and then you keep going. So what we've done is we went, if you go from the very beginning, you go from the vat.
The big vat, yeah.
The big vat, so it gets crushed and it goes and pressed and it goes into the barrels. And then it conditions there until it's all fermented out. And then it goes, once again, you siphon it, rack it into the demijohn, let that condition. And then say around Christmas, if you really need wine, okay, you rack it into gallons, constantly leaving the sediment that's at the bottom behind.
Yeah, yeah.
So by the time you get to the gallons, then you go into your Perrier bottles. And then you go from your Perrier bottle, you can either go into a wine carafe if you want. And then it goes into the glass. So by the time it gets to the glass.
So it's been filtered numerous times.
Well, yeah, and it's all natural. It's not being put through a synthetic filter. It just, you leave all of the junk. And this is the best. When you get a demijohn of wine and you rack it into gallons and you look at the bottom of the demijohn and there's like hardly any sediment.
You know you have a good wine.
You know it. You know for a fact. What a feeling it is to be able to have that. You just know, I've got like a demijohn is 54 liters. You know that you have 54 liters of fantastic wine.
Yeah. That's got to make anybody who loves wine smile.
Yeah. Oh yeah. For sure. For sure. Yeah.
So then essentially that's it. Then it goes into the bottle and you just cap it, right? And that's, it's fine. Is there a process to the capping, or you just, how do you seal it?
So if you use, say for example, if you use a Perrier bottle, you just basically use the cap and then you just tighten it, make sure it's airlocked or, you know, tight. And you try to fill up as much as you can.
To keep air out, right?
That's right. Yeah. And usually it's pretty good. And actually,
that sounds so simple.
Well, like I said, winemaking, it's actually quite a simple process. You just have to have the right equipment. There's just three things. It's like, you got to have the equipment. You've got to make sure that you're good. You have good sanitation practices, right? And temperature.
Right. So then why, I know they have, like, you could go to the liquor store and get these wine making kits. Mm-hmm. Why does the wine taste so bad?
Well, okay. I remember we were talking about this before too, and I've actually have done wine making kits as well, because you know what, it's nice to be able to try a grape that maybe is not available. Right.
Okay.
Also, too, the wine kits only make 30 liters at a time. So, I mean, you're only committing to 30 liters. And you know what? If it's something that maybe it's not pleasing to you, okay, well, you know what? You either just drink it or give it away, right? But the thing about it is it's not like making, like, say, 500 liters, right?
What comes in a wine kit?
Okay, so the way a wine kit works is it comes with the juice. Okay.
That it's already been pressed? Is that what you're talking about?
Correct. Yeah. It's just straight up juice that has, it's basically unfermented, which means that there's lots of sugar content in it.
Gotcha.
Okay. So it'll come with the juice. It will come with a yeast packet. All right. So you can start the fermentation. It will come with some form of Camden tablet, which is like, was it bimetasulfate, I believe, which is a cleaning solution. Because they want you to add that before you bottle it, because they want to make darn sure that the fermentation stopped. And that's the way to kill fermentation.
Okay.
To do that. And sometimes it comes with oak chips. If you want to have an oak taste, and pretty much that's what's in a wine kit.
So do you, you won't do that now since you just make your own wine?
Well, as we were talking before, there are actually really good wine kits out there, but you've got to pay the money. You have. There are different grades. You can get yourself a nice wine kit for maybe $50 or $60. But what you're getting is you're getting maybe an inferior product. You might be getting juice where there's not enough sugar in it. So what they do is they add sugar to it. So now you're getting less grape taste, more alcohol taste.
Right.
When it's fermented, you know.
So then if someone's thinking about making wine and using a kit, you're saying they should pay the premium dollar. And what would that be?
Premium dollar, I'm thinking anywhere between $150 to $200.
Okay.
For 30 liters.
Okay. So then, if I were to do that, a wine kit, why would I go on the cheap side? It just doesn't make any sense.
Well, it's what you value, right? It's right. How much you want to pay. If you find that buying a cheaper kit, is basically, there's not much taste difference, then you're probably going to go on the cheaper side, right?
Right. Now, do you, when you have your wine now, do you know how to pair it with food at the table, or you don't really care? You just...
You know, that's an interesting thing. I mean, yes, I mean, you always with the wines, you buy them at the store and it has food pairings and like suggestions on what to eat with your wine and stuff like that. I mean, to me, we make our wine is table wine. It's something you drink every day. And
gotcha.
It's not like a Super Tuscan or, like a Primitivo. I don't know. You know, one of those wines where it's like, oh, but you just like, you know, you're paying like $40, $50 a bottle at the liquor store because it's just fantastic.
Right.
Wine, right. No. And our wine is, I love it. It's fantastic. The one thing I enjoy about our wine is it, like I said, it's made from grapes. I know for a fact, cause we buy them ourselves. Yeah. We see them, we know they're grapes and we,
right.
You know, but as far as food is concerned, I mean, yeah, I enjoy red wine with pasta.
Okay.
With steak.
Nice.
Right. I mean, even if you're going to have like make your own hamburgers, it's nice to have a glass of red wine with that as well. And of course, if I'm having fish or chicken or something lighter, you know what I mean? Yeah. I would prefer a white wine.
Right,
I still drink red with it because that's all we make. We make red wine.
Gotcha.
But yes, we do buy wine. Like my wife actually, she's not a big fan of her wine, and her thing has always been about, well, she's worried about pesticides and different things. So yeah. She's more of the organic type, right? So, I mean, she'll buy like any wine that's certified organic, or if you look at French wine, French grapes actually have to be certified organic. So anything that you buy that's directly from France.
And I heard even Germany, they're really strict and regimented with the organic label.
Mm-hmm.
I think Europe does a better job than we do. Is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. And you know, the funny thing about that is I remember a few years back, this is going back about 7 or 8 years, my wife and I decided that we were going to go to the Niagara region and we were actually going to buy our own grapes. Now this is a hard thing to do. It's hard to buy Niagara grapes. Number one, the growing season is later. So you're not making wine until probably middle of October, end of October.
Okay.
Okay. Secondly, usually when they have grapes for sale in the Niagara region, it's probably because it's a young winery, it's some new vines. You can't sell the new vines to the wineries because they're too young. They got to do something with them, so they sell them to the public, right?
Interesting.
And we bought them, and they sell grapes by the ton, okay? And there's a specific price per how old the vine is, right?
Okay.
So depending upon which winery is buying what grape, obviously it's going to cost more if the vine is like 10 years or older than if it's like maybe a 5-year vine. For starters, the vine at the beginning doesn't even produce anything. And then when it does, it's going to produce the grapes with a lot of water, okay? It's not going to have as much sugar content. And it's going to have a more sour taste to it. Of course, this is how we learned this. It's because we bought some red and we bought some white and we made wine and the white wine was terrible.
Because the vine wasn't old enough, you're saying.
You know, the other thing too, though, when you make white wine at home, the best way to do it is you press it, you ferment it as quick as possible, and then you don't let it sit like red white. Once it's ready, you condition it until it's clear. Then you put it in gallons, bottle it, and drink it.
When you say condition it, what does it mean?
What it means is you're going to let it sit, finish out its fermentation if necessary. You also want the sediment of the wine. You want it to clear, right?
Okay.
So you want it to, and once that's clear, then for white wine, you bottle it, you drink it, because it just does not have the same shelf life as red wine, because red wine, the red skins, they actually really protect the wine.
Is that why they refrigerate white wines?
I've seen
white wines in the fridge all the time.
No, white wines are in the fridge because it's a taste, right? It's kind of, okay, so to compare it, it's like, say, for example, if you were to take a lager, and drink it warm. It has a lot to do, I guess, how it's conditioned. For example, an ale, if you take a beer like an ale, okay, it is top fermented, and which means that it ferments from the top, goes down, okay, and you can ferment it at room temperature. So it's going to taste better.
When you drink it at room temperature.
When you drink it warm.
Yeah.
Lagers and pilsners are bottom fermented, so the yeast comes from the bottom and goes up. But the only way that that yeast works is it has to be cooler. So lagers and pilsners traditionally were brewed in caverns, caves and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So if you drink it at room temperature, you are not going to get the flavor profile because it was not made under those temperatures. So wine, particular white wine, it's the same deal. It's probably conditioned at colder temperatures.
Right.
And if you actually drink white wine at room temperature, it doesn't taste right.
Your argument's very logical. Makes sense now.
Yeah.
What you're talking about.
Yeah. It has to be consumed in the environment, in the temperature environment in which it was produced is basically the rule. So
that is a lot of value you provided. So as we wind down now, if you're familiar with what we do here on Tucci Talks, we do a little game.
Excellent.
Okay. You're going to be playing, it's our Guess What segment, and you're going to be playing Wine Parody. It's a play on Jeopardy.
Okay.
I'm going to give you 10 questions.
Okay.
Or I'll give you the answers. You know how Jeopardy works.
Okay.
And you got to put it in the question form.
Okay.
If you answer six and you get the pass score,
mm-hmm.
you win a Tucci Talks mug.
Impressive.
Number one, Burgundy, specifically red Burgundy, or Bourgogne Rouge, as it's known in France.
What is a type of wine?
I'll give you that. French wine.
Yeah, okay.
From the Pinot Noir grapes. Good job. Okay, that's one. Cabernet Sauvignon with more than 700,000 acres worldwide.
Oh geez. I don't know specifically, but like what is a huge vineyard?
Yes, I'm going to give you that.
Sorry,
it is what is the most widely planted grape in the world.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Number three, 750 milliliters or about 25 fluid ounces.
Oh, what is the standard, what is the standard size or capacity of a bottle of wine?
That is correct.
Okay.
Number four, it's called the Nebuchadnezzar and it holds 15 liters of wine. That's the equivalent of 20 regular bottles in a single huge bottle.
Oh, Nebuchadnezzar, I know this one. Oh, Nebuchadnezzar. Okay, I'm gonna go, what is it's like a clay pot to hold wine, isn't it?
What is the biggest kind of wine bottle?
Okay, is it a bottle?
That's what I don't know. I'm not the expert.
Okay, no, because I know that there's like clay pots that hold wine.
We'll give you half a point. We're gonna give you half a point.
All right, I get a half a point. Yay!
All right, number five, about 200 grapes or 2.5 pounds of grapes. That's the answer. About 200 grapes.
Yeah.
Or 2.5 pounds of grapes.
Okay. I am going to say, what is the amount of grapes that it takes to make a bottle of wine?
That is correct. You're on fire, dude. You are on fire, dude. Number six, 60 gallons.
60 gallons. Okay. Oh, my God. Okay. 60 gallons. I'm going to take a stab at what is the standard size of a wine vat?
Yeah, what is the amount of wine in a barrel? We'll give you half a point.
Half a point, okay.
Number seven, you're almost there.
Okay.
One more point, you win. Winery uncovered in 4100 BC. It's located in Armenia.
Oh, that's a tough one. That's a tough one. Oh.
Tough one.
Oh, I'm sorry. I got to pass.
That's fine.
Oh my God.
What is the oldest winery in the world?
Okay. I thought you wanted the name of it. Okay, I could have guessed off that.
Yeah, you could always guess. Always guess.
Oh, okay.
Number 8, red, white, pink, or rosé, orange, and blue.
Orange and blue? Oh, jeez. Wow, I'm going to say, what are your colors of wine? But
that is correct.
I've never seen orange or blue, though.
There was an episode on Netflix on a show, mm-hmm. and they make orange wine. It was fascinating.
Okay.
Number 9, this is the bonus now. Number 9, because you won the mug. Congratulations.
Oh, thanks, dude.
Considered to have the largest area, this country has 1,154,000 hectares of vineyard throughout its land.
Oh my God.
Just guess a country.
I'm just going to say, what is Italy?
What is Spain?
It's Spain, eh?
Last question. Yeah. Over 24.7 billion liters.
That must be the what is the approximate amount of wine consumed yearly, like worldly, like
yes.
yearly.
You are correct. Okay. Excellent job.
Oh, wow.
You were tremendous. That was tremendous.
I'm just like as far as the wine question, where hectares of land, like Spain definitely is huge. Italy, Portugal, I mean,
yeah.
They're starting to make wine in China now. Like, they're literally clearing out land and growing vines so that China wants to be a player now in the wine market. It's nuts. Like, in France, right?
Well, it's a source of an opportunity for revenue.
Mm-hmm.
What is it? What's the market cap for wine? Like, what do they produce in terms of money? Like, what does the business make, the wine industry?
That I'm not sure of.
It's got to be in the billions yearly.
Oh, for sure. The one thing I do know, though, is just getting into something like that, like, you're not making money for like 10, 15 years because
Fair
of how much the work it takes just to get started up, right?
Yeah.
So
since you have an Italian background, aside from wine, are you doing sausages this year?
Yeah, we do cured meat, so we'll do sausages, sobrasata, capocollo, we'll do some lonza. We did the sauce.
You did the tomato sauce already?
We did the tomato sauce, yeah. That usually happens around the end of August, beginning of September.
I don't know if I told you this, but I used to do the sauce with my dad, me and my middle brother.
Mm-hmm.
We fired him. We fired him from sauce making.
Oh, your dad?
Yeah, because it was supposed to be a family tradition.
Right.
And we spend time with the family.
Mm-hmm.
He made it an exercise in telling us each year how stupid we are at doing things.
Oh, yeah. But he does it out of love, though. It's out of love,
I don't care.
It's like, I love you. I know you're going to fail, but I love you.
is there anything you want to add? Maybe, is there actually, you know what? Is there a resource that people can perhaps look into, like a book or a...
Okay, you know what? I was actually thinking about that, and I was looking up it last night, and I read this book maybe about 10, 12 years ago, and I could not find the name. Finally, I did enough playing around, I found it what it was. And the reason why this book is highly recommended is because the fellow who wrote it actually is a wine importer in New York City now.
Amazing.
He's originally from Italy. He moved here in 1974. So he was at the tail end of the third wave of Italian immigration. And the reason why they moved is because they were really poor. Like, could you believe it? Like, how many years after World War II and you still have people that just can't make it in Europe. So he moved over here. It's a fellow by the name of Sergio, people say Esposito, but it's Esposito is his name. Okay.
I'm going to put this resource on the website.
Okay. The book is called Passion on the Vine.
Okay.
Right. Really, really good book. And interesting too, though, the word, this is something that my father and I were talking about, but the word Esposito basically means exposed or like exhibition, like what, let's just say that someone in Italy with a last name, there was a good chance that they were actually adopted. They were orphaned. And that's a lot of them were just, that's what they were named. So, and a lot of them obviously were adopted. And what he explained to me is that you would go to a place and they would have like this sliding door and it's like on a carousel and they'd have all these babies behind this carousel. And then what would happen is if would pull up and the parents would go up and they would open up the window. They'd look at the baby and say, oh, okay, we'll take that one. Or, you know, let's go to the next one.
Wow.
So this is how adoption happened in Italy, like years ago, and that's the origin of the name Esposito. Is exposed,
right?
So so that always stuck with me, the name. But I don't know Sergio Esposito's background, but the book really stuck with me because his experience of watching his father at the dinner table. Right? He always had to have a glass of wine. Always.
Right.
It was a ritual. In the book, it said that my father, if he couldn't have wine, he said, I would just rather have soup and nothing else because the meal is not even worth it if I can't have a glass of wine with it.
Unbelievable.
Yeah. So unbelievable. Very, very religious about having wine at the table.
Dino, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thank you so much for your contribution. Your passion comes through. And I have to say, I loved listening to you today.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thanks for coming on. Thanks for coming on. All right. See you, brother.
Okay. Ciao.
Ciao. I hope everyone enjoyed Dino's thorough explanations today and some of the deep-rooted traditions that many cultures possess. It's really a wonder to see. I speak from the heart when I say that my dad made wine out of necessity if he actually wanted to drink it. That generation came from a place of lack, and they never grew out of it. Embedded plus ingrained gives you the word ingredited, and saving and never spending is ingredited in that generation. I hope you enjoyed the episode today. Please subscribe to the podcast. Give it a like. Next week, we will be exploring a topic that is a thread in many of our lives. Some of us don't even know how we keep getting up and we keep going. So we will share some stories of the power of perseverance. I am really looking forward to that discussion. That is a wrap for me. Have a glass of wine today. We will consider November 9th National Wine Day. Enjoy the rest of your week. Take care of each other. And don't forget to add, woo! A little funk, woo, to your day.